You're listening to episode 17 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu, your friendly host. In this episode, we're going to be talking about a couple of little random tips, like hacking into OS X and changing the password, how to extract an RPM on Slackware, some Bash one-liners, and a tip from Ken Fallon about safe Bash scripting, screenwriter.el briefly, and a couple of other philosophical musings. So what do you say? Let's get started. So the first thing I guess I'll touch on is just a little bit of news. So you'll recall the episode where I was completely going crazy over the Emacs module that allows people to create screenplays in Emacs. That, of course, as I've said before, and I'm not going to keep saying it, but I guess I'll say it one more time, huge deal for me. It's just something that I do every day. So finding that module for Emacs really, really changed the way I was able to work. So that was great. And screenplay.el was definitely the most user-friendly, sort of natural-feeling method that anyone that I've seen has come up for writing screenplays on Linux. Well, and anything else that Emacs will run on, which is practically everything, which is what makes it so great. But anyway, it's this really great little plugin, but it was missing a couple of things. It was missing transitions. It was it had what I felt were really, really repetitive and confusing keyboard key bindings, and so I wrote a patch for the transitions, as I think I mentioned before on the show, and then I came up with some, I don't know, I think they're better key bindings for the process of switching between different blocks. About 6 months ago, I contacted the author of screenplay.el, told him about the patch. I waited about a month. I pinged him again at a different address. Waited another month, pinged him again at a different address. Waited again. I think I commented on the Savannah code hosting site. So I tried to contact this guy, and I just couldn't. And finally, I realized that if I was going to comfortably be able to refer people to this weird thing called Emacs with this weird thing called screenplay.el that they can use to do their screenplays in, expecting the average Joe to do a patch, that's a bit much. I mean, expecting them to get used to the idea of Emacs, I can do that. I can comfortably tell them, you need to learn this application. It's better than what you've been using. It's more universal than what you've been using. It saves everything in plain text. Trust me. Get to learn Emacs and screenplay.el. That I can do. Trying to get them to apply a patch felt a little bit stranger, so I thought, well, I could just do the patch and then distribute the file, you know, the patched version of screenplay myself. And I was doing that for a little while off of Slacker Media, and finally I figured it would be better, I think, if I just forked the project. It felt a little bit weird to fork a project because I'm not a Lisp programmer. It's I'm not sure the honesty of saying, here is screenwriter.el and I'm the new maintainer of it. Because, I mean, if I had to maintain it, I honestly don't know how well I would do. But on the other hand, I don't know how well I wouldn't do either. So I decided to go ahead and fork it. So I submitted a fork of screenplay.el to nongnu.org, and they reviewed it, and they were happy enough with it that they went ahead and approved it as a project. So I am now the maintainer of Vance L. Simpson's very, very good screenplay.el, which has been rebranded as screenwriter.el just to differentiate it away from the original. And I have to say, it's a really cool little project. You can find the site at nongnu.org/screenwriter, and that has the new transitions patch applied, and it has modified key bindings to key bindings that I just think make a lot more sense, which actually are meta S for slug line, meta A for action, meta D for dialogue, and meta T for transitions, which admittedly is different than Final Draft or Movie Magic screenwriting. It's just still better. It works a lot easier rather than tab, 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 return, tab, 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 return, and tab, 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 return. I might have exponentially made those a little bit worse than they actually are, but still I think the key bindings are better. And besides, it's a pretty easy modification if people want to use different ones. So that's all I'll say about that, because I know the number of people writing screenplays in Emacs is not that many, so I'm sure that you don't need me to keep going on about it. But yeah, check it out if you want, or just be aware of it and keep that in mind whenever people ask you about screenwriting on Linux. Recommend this before Celtics if they're at all vaguely geeky, because this one is far superior. Of course, it's all Vance L. Simpson's work, but it really is a lot better. Plain text and a lot more cross-platform potential. So I've been doing a lot of bash scripting lately, kind of tying into what we were just talking about. Screenplay Tools is a set of bash scripts that I created for the screenwriting stuff, where it will extract information from your screenplays and generate reports and stuff like that. And then, unrelated to that, there have been some photo album kinds of stuff that I've been doing just for friends and family who... strangely, after seeing the movie The Social Network, a lot of people I know, and again, take that in context, a lot in this realm of speaking is more like, you know, 2 to 3 people, but that's a lot to me in this case. But a lot of people, after seeing The Social Network, that I know, they are shying away from Facebook, interestingly. I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know what exactly. I had always imagined, I thought that the movie was fairly positive toward Facebook. I didn't think it was a film that demonized Facebook, but that does seem to be the unintended effect. People are kind of less interested in Facebook after they see that movie, at least if they also know me. Maybe it's a kind of compound effect, because I'm always scoffing at Facebook, and then at the same time they go see this movie and kind of see how it's really just one person's business. Really, it's not a service. It's just one person getting all your info and getting paid a lot of money for that. But anyway, the effect is that they don't want to post their photos on Facebook, and I was trying to come up with an easy, quick way of generating web albums. I realized doing that in Bash is completely wrong. I should be doing it in PHP or something, but I'm still working on the whole anything but Bash thing. But point is that I've actually been doing a lot of Bash scripting, and I've got some little tips here, one-liners or just things to keep in mind as you Bash script. And Ken Fallon actually reminded me that whenever I speak of Bash scripting and whenever I Bash script, I should be sure to do full paths to the executables. Because, of course, one of the, I guess, really simple ways of attacking a computer is to give it a new version of some common command, and then get people to run that command, and instead of running the normal LS or whatever, then they are running your new version of LS that happens to be an alias for RM-RF everything. So, yeah, full path names for important things is a really good idea. The only possible issue I could see there is maybe some Unix system placing a command in some non-standard folder or a different folder than what you are used to on your scripting box. So that could be a problem, I guess, although I have not yet actually run into that. And I do most of my scripting on Linux, and then I run a lot of it on the Mac clients around here at work. So you'd think that I'd run into that issue. One issue that I had, completely unrelated to anything, was that there was a weird bug on Mac OS X. I think it was an update, and I think it was from 10.6. It was to 10.6.4, I think, was the evil number that's sticking in my head. But it somehow zeroed out a bunch of commands, including the rm command. So if you did an ls-lh on /bin, or wherever rm is, it's probably in /bin, it was there, rm was there, but the contents of the file, or it was 0 bytes. It was a 0 byte size, file size. And this was not just with rm, it was actually with a bunch of them. ID, so I could never check the ID of the user, which I wanted to do in this script because I wanted to make sure that they were running it as, I was running it as root. Bunch of different commands, just completely zeroed out. Very, very strange. But anyway, and it wasn't just on one computer. Again, this is on like 30 computers that got updated, and after the update, everything, or not everything, but weird random instances of important system commands got zeroed out. Not that that actually has anything to do with anything, that's just a tale from the trench, I guess. But yeah, so fool paths in your shell scripts for greater security. Well, speaking of Macs, I have not tried the latest Mac OS. Don't really have a desire to, although that's not going to mean that I don't have to try it out, because I do work around a lot of Macs all the time, apparently. Can't get away from them. I got away from like 1 year. There was like 1 year last year, the year before, that I actually didn't even go near a Mac. It was really pretty cool. But anyway, I haven't tried Lion. Don't care to, probably will eventually. But one thing I really am curious about, whether they fixed or not, was the super easy way that you could do a password change on OS X. Turns out that OS X ships with a single user mode enabled by default. You can boot the machine with Command S held down, and you'll get into the so-called single user mode. And single user mode is you sitting at a root prompt with an unmounted hard drive and no kind of password authentication or anything. It's just you and the computer as root. So that obviously sounds like an interesting situation to be in. The only thing you really have to do, I mean, you can type in, if you know the user's username on that computer, you could type in password or PASSWD username and it will give you an error. And that's because the file system isn't actually mounted yet. So mounting the file system is pretty easy. You can simply do a mount /dev/rdisk0 and then some slice. In my experience so far, it's been on slice 2 usually. So it would be mount /dev/rdisk0s2/mnt, for instance. And then you've just mounted the hard drive and you can do whatever you want to with any of the information on it, such as passwd space first user inherits all the full root privileges pretty much, so change that password and you've got everything you need. I've done this a lot because people are always bringing their computers to me for repair, whether it's on the job or it's just their personal computer and they need a favor, and of course they don't remember their password. I've talked about it before, the Mac OS installer just doesn't ever indoctrinate people on, well, a lot of different things, but certainly what the concept of a username is, much less that their password actually matters. So that's something that happens a lot. So lots of changing passwords. I'm of two minds about the way that that's done. It's actually really, really convenient. I really appreciate it. I don't have to go grab the original CD and boot it up and go into an admin sort of rescue mode and change the password. I can just do it really as quickly as it takes to boot, practically. So that's kind of convenient. And as they say, physical security. I mean, if you surrender your computer to someone, then if you really expect that password to keep them out of anything, it's probably not going to happen, you know, because given enough time with that password data somewhere on that drive, it's going to get changed or discovered or whatever if people are trying hard enough. So who knows? It seems really, really easy to change, but I'm sure it's really, really easy to change on any other system as well, especially with John, the password cracking application. Although, to be fair, I've run John on various computers for fun, and it really takes them either a long time or, I guess, longer than I want to wait when I'm just doing it for fun, to crack the password. So holding down Command S and just changing it as quickly as it generally takes to boot up, that does seem a little bit weird. But now you know, so have fun. I don't know if they're going to have that in Lion. They might have changed that, but they might not have. It'll be interesting to see. So there are two packaging management issues that I wanted to talk about today. One with PCBSD, which I'm running on a spare laptop right now, and the other is with Slackware. So take your pick. BSD? Okay. So the PCBSD package management system is done two different ways. There's the ports directory, the /usr/ports, and for those, you just go into the port that you want, as long as you've installed it. I went over that last episode. And then you type in make install clean, and it makes the ports. And it has lists of dependencies, and it will actually resolve most of those dependencies, and it has some config files that it will bring up, and you can tell it what configuration options you do or do not want. I've gotten almost into the habit of just accepting the defaults, because it seems like every time I try to add to it, it introduces some new level of dependency, and then it starts to kind of get screwed up. So I've kind of started reverse engineering, as it were, the process of installing stuff from ports, and treat it more like Slack builds, where you kind of have to do it yourself anyway, your dependency resolution. So I'll kind of look at what I want to get installed, and then I'll look at the config options that are available, and kind of bail out of installing it at that moment, and then I will go back and install the dependencies that I've just identified that I want, and then I'll go in and install that port. That's just been kind of working out better for me. I have a feeling it's the choice of packages that I'm making and some of the stupid options that I'm enabling just in case. I don't even know why I'm doing it, to be honest, but that's kind of what I've done. But the important thing there is that there is a command called make config, and that will bring up just the configuration options for that port that you're about to install, which is important because if you've attempted to install something and then it turns out there's a broken link or one of the options wasn't such a good option to enable, then you can do a make config again, and it will bring those configuration options back up, and you can check things back on or back off or whatever you need to do to make it actually build for yourself. But of course, like I said last time, ports can take a long time to go through. There's no, from what I can tell, there's no, and I went into PCBSD and asked about this in their IRC channel, and asked if there was any kind of allowance for queue files, kind of like with Slack build, or rather as SBO PKG, where you can say, okay, I want this port, that port, and that port installed. So go do that, and I'll go get a cup of coffee or two and come back when you're done. No way to do that from what I can tell. I mean, obviously you can script it yourself, but there's no way to, there's nothing that exists that anyone knew of that does that for you. So the whole port process can take a long time, and if you're building and installing, you know, KDE 4, first of all, it is going to take a long time, and then you think to yourself, gee, I should really go and install FFmpeg as well. Well, you're going to be waiting for KDE 4 to finish probably for a while. I mean, you could do it as a concurrent kind of build probably, but again, this is not a very powerful computer, so it's not going to help things. So point is that sometimes ports is something that you don't want to do for a certain package. You just don't feel the need to build it from source. I do that all the time. I mean, the applications that I really care about, I always build from source, and then the stuff that it's just kind of one of those fluffy little applications that I just like to have, but it's not something that I actually rely on or whatever, then I'll just install those from a binary distribution. So on PCBSD, the way to do that would be something called pbidir.com. And this is an official website of PCBSD containing all these different binary distributed packages that you can install on PCBSD, either 32-bit or 64-bit. And when you click on when you go to the site, you should go to the site, honestly, as a person, like, even if you're not using PCBSD, just go there anyway, because I want you to see this site. It's really, really, really slick. You just go to pbidir.com, go there, you'll find the first page is a list of the categories: archivers, astronomy, audio, benchmarks, biology, CAD, communications, database, desktop utilities, and so on and so on. And then you can click into that category, and you can either browse or you can do a search for a certain package. And then you click on the package that you want. You have a choice between the 32-bit build and the 64-bit build. I'm running 32-bit, which I haven't done in a long time, but that was the disk that I picked up from Self, I think it was. It tells you the MD5 sum. It gives you a list of mirrors and stuff like that. In the end, you click wherever you want to click in order to download that file. And it says, or it asks you, rather, what you want to do with that file. At least I should say, it asks me on my system what I want to do with that file. I think Firefox might not do that by default on this system. You have to go in and prompt it to ask you or something like that. But I was using Conqueror the first time I did this, so it asked me if I wanted to open this PBI file in something called PBI Launcher, which turns out to be like this neat little installer wizard, which I've actually mentioned before. The first time I ever installed PCBSD, I remember on this show mentioning this, but I guess I had kind of forgotten the workflow of that, and I was really pleasantly surprised here, because once again, I think really people are so used to, and I mean everyone, I mean not just noobs, I'm talking about us, we're really used to going online, finding an application we want to install, and then installing it from there. Having this main repository called PBIDIR with all the packages on it that you could want, and you can just click on it to download it, and then it launches in this nice little launcher that helps you, steps you through the process of installing it, which is really, really simple because it's a binary distribution. It without fail, it just kept working and working and working and working. I was really, really, really impressed. And that's, I guess the reason I was so impressed is because it must not do that for me on other distribution on Linux distributions, because I mean, just too often have I been either writing an article or trying to demonstrate something to someone, like a friend. That's always the worst time for, you know, I should never do demos for anyone. It's a horrible idea. They always go wrong. But you know, sitting there doing demos for people, say, look how easy it is to install applications on Linux, and you go into the little repository, and that's a little bit weird anyway, because they're like, well, wait a minute, where are you going? You're going into your own computer to look for applications? That doesn't make any sense to me. Whereas people know that a web browser means it's on the internet. So they see this little repository browser like Synaptic or PackageKit or whatever, and then you're going in and you're searching for something that doesn't even, you don't even know what you're searching for, so you're just like, well, just search for Mutt. Well, they're like, well, what's Mutt? That's an email thing. Well, how do I know about Mutt? How do I know to search for it? Well, you kind of don't. So it's really difficult to kind of make people understand and even grasp ourselves what exactly we're looking at, where all this information is coming from. Whereas if we go online to a site officially sanctioned by this distribution, it's their place that they keep all their stuff. You go to these categories that tell you exactly what you're in store for. You want a graphic application? Go into the graphics application directory or page, and then scroll through the list, and then the one that you think looks nice, click on it, read up a little bit about it, and then if you really want to install it, and it'll launch a friendly little wizard. And even me, who's never been on Windows for a day in his life, I've seen that stupid little install wizard thing on Windows. And of course Mac OS X has little install wizards as well. So the concept is already there. It's embedded in our brain. So I really thought that the PBIDIR, they totally have this right. I'm really impressed by this. So that's the PCBSD version of installing from binaries. Of course, Linux has that as well, RPMs, .debs, and Slackware can also use those kinds of things. I mean, Slackware actually, a lot of it's binary anyway, the .tgzs and tbzs and txzs, those are binary packages, generally speaking. Yeah, it's really just Slack builds that are built from source every time. But sometimes on Slackware, you're looking for a package that just hasn't been put out on Slack builds, or you can find it on Slack builds, but it's a slightly older version and you want the latest and greatest. So one thing that I've found is really, really helpful is to kind of keep in mind that there's a bunch of RPMs out there on the interweb, and a lot of those RPMs are completely usable by Slackware, believe it or not. Yes, Slackware actually ships with RPM. The way that people, I think, typically use RPM, at least my perception, I haven't sat around and talked to other Slackware users about this, but I believe the way that they typically use it is with RPM to TGZ is the command, and that's RPM and then the number 2 and then the TGZ. And what that does is take an RPM and it converts it into a .tgz, meaning that you can then install that RPM in theory, just like any old Slack package, Slackware package that was written specifically for Slackware. Now, obviously, if it's an RPM, for instance, for Publican, perfect example, Publican has about 1,000,001 Perl dependencies. So if you try to install Publican from an RPM, just using RPM to TGZ, all it's going to really contain are the Publican schema files and the Publican specific Perl commands, and it's not going to be able to do all kinds of fancy dependency resolution and go out and get all those Perl packages, so that won't work. But if it's something that you know that you've built everything up to the point that now you're ready for that one binary, and you've satisfied those dependencies yourself, then you can use that with great success. The other way that I've used the RPM capabilities on Slackware is to actually unpackage RPMs. And again, actually, specifically for Publican most recently, this was really, really useful because Publican has a lot of dependencies, and I wanted to see how the Fedora maintainers, and I mean, Publican comes straight from Fedora and Red Hat. It's their tool. So I wanted to see how they were resolving everything and what they thought the dependencies really were. So I wanted a spec file, basically. I wanted the part of that RPM that lists, well, really, that does all the work in an RPM. So in order to get that, you can use some of these little tools on Slackware to carefully unpackage and dissect an RPM. It's RPM to CPIO, and again, that's the number 2. So it's RPM number 2 CPIO space, let's just say publican.rpm, and then the greater than symbol to redirect the output to publican.cpio. Okay, now you've got this CPIO file, so now we need to extract that. And the way you do that is CPIO space dash dash extract, and then you redirect into that command, so that's a less than symbol, publican.cpio. That sends your publican file, your publican.cpio file, into CPIO with the extract flag, and it doesn't take that long, so you can do an ls, and sure enough, you'll see a publican dot TGZ and a publican.spec, where the TGZ contains a bunch of other data and the spec file. The TGZ might be interesting. You might want to look in there for the binary bits and pieces of that package, but the thing that I usually use it for is just to get to that spec file. It's getting really close to the time for a cup of coffee, but before we go over for our coffee break, I wanted to mention that there are going to be some slight server changes over at unixporn.com. So unixporn.com, of course, is the screenshot sharing site. It's just sort of homegrown Flickr, I guess, for screenshots of your Linux and BSD and whatever else, screenshots. So the pitch was that people want to see each other's desktops, and it doesn't have to be anything spectacular, it doesn't have to be fancy effects in mid-motion, it can just be what you're staring at every day, or just a computer that you're particularly proud of. And it's kind of difficult to share this little computer that you put together with people, really, you know, but if you take a screenshot and put it online and then describe it in the description or something, that's kind of a nice way of showing and telling. So that's what UnixPorn.com is. It's not porn, it's Unix. So check that site out. We're not actually taking new registrations right now because of spam issues. Go figure, a site with porn in the name gets a lot of spam. I'm shocked. But yeah, so go over there and just email me for an account and I can set you up. Although another admin over there might have opened up registration behind my back. I'm not really sure because I think I've seen some new people on there, so maybe it is back open. I'm not sure. Either way, you should check that site out. But also, the exciting thing about that is that, I mean, up until now it's been hosted on free GoDaddy web hosting, which a lot of my sites have traditionally been hosted on because it's free. I don't have to pay for it. So that's a big advantage for me. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I don't have to ask listeners for donations and silly things like that. You know, well, we need your help to keep the show going. I don't need your help to keep the show going. GoDaddy just lets me post whatever I want to on these stupid sites because I bought a domain from them, so big deal. And if you don't like the stupid GoDaddy ads that they impose on us all, then just install Adblocker, and it really won't matter anymore, will it? So that's what I've been doing, and turns out that the last known god decided to go get a job at a big server company or something, and as part of the deal, he kind of inherited some extra server space. So he's actually one of the admins over at UnixPorn.com, and he decided that it would be a good idea to finally move UnixPorn.com onto a real server, you know, I mean, like, actually get it onto a server without ads and stuff like that. So I'm going to migrate that site very, very soon here over to the Last Known Gods server space, and there it will live, and it's all grown up now. It's a real website, so go and check it out and make it even more of a real website with lots and lots of content and users and communities and people thriving and all that other good stuff. I should mention here also that Ken Fallon, who of course is a really, really sort of, I don't know, this kind of sneaky supporter of all this kind of open source and Creative Commons stuff, he just kind of quietly does things. You know, he just kind of takes over HPR one day and then kind of, or not takes over, but, you know, puts it, gets it off of life support and gets it back into, you know, recovery. And he just kind of secretly sets up this mirror for a lot of Linux links. And he set up a mirror for, at the time, the Bad Apples, now the GNU World Order. And I never really used that server space because the GNU World Order, I mean, it's, if you think about it, it's just such a, I mean, all it is are my shows. You know, I mean, yeah, it's got that website, but it's not like a site where anything happens. It's just show notes. And the rest of it is just audio files. And I've lately been really trying to keep the audio file sizes down just because I'm seeing that it does add up after a while and people don't want to sit around for downloads all the time. But it's just, it's 5 or 6 seasons now of just audio. And I mean, why not use GoDaddy for that? If they're going to give me free server space to just dump a whole bunch of audio on and give me unlimited bandwidth, I feel like I might as well go ahead and take them up on that offer for the GNU World Order. However, I did move one of my old sites, or not old, but a site that I kind of use as a backup site. It used to host Slacker Media, it used to host some of the Fat Chance Lester stuff, and then it would host, you know, it keeps hosting different things. So I've moved some stuff over to Ken Fallon's server. So I can at least say to myself when I go to bed at night that I'm not really relying on GoDaddy. I don't have a whole bunch of GoDaddy ads out there with all of my content. So that is kind of cool. Bad Apples or thebadapples.info is the domain. So the show, GNU World Order, is just going to sit on GoDaddy because it is free. It's unlimited bandwidth. They've never complained about it. Basically, I'm of the mind that it is not broken, so I'm not going to fix it. What is broken is the fact that neither of us, you or I, seem to have a cup of coffee in our hand. Oh, well, actually, you do, but not you. And certainly I don't. So let's go get a cup of coffee, and we'll come back for the old Linux philosophy bit. Yeah, this is definitely good coffee. This is a very fine cup of coffee. I'm still working on Paul Outbox's Kona blend, and I've been mixing it in with some kind of Sumatra coffee that I get from a local cafe. I don't know where they get it from, but it's really good. I hope yours is also very good. Well, I should mention before I get into the next big segment that Ohio Linux Fest is less than a month away, so if you haven't registered, haven't made room plans or rideshare plans, do that really soon. It's really, really close, and it's a really cool festival. A lot of fun to go to. I'll be there. I'm probably giving a talk, I think, as far as I know. I don't know. I've been pretty busy, so I've seen emails that claim that I pitched a talk, and I'm certainly up for talking, so I will if it's correct. I was hoping to do one on Publican, actually, because it's a really cool tool, but they want video, so, a video talk, so I'll probably be doing stuff about video instead. But if you want to learn Publican, hit me up. Anyway, Ohio Linux Fest, just around the corner, be aware of that. It's a really fun convention, very, very great community event, and I think, as with most of the Linux conventions that I've been to so far, these are really great examples of how open the geek community really is. You do encounter little groups of people in life that aren't very receptive to new people, you know, or people who they perceive to be different than themselves, things like that. Geek community, I've never experienced that. Geek community has no expectation on you. If you want to shake hands, you can shake hands. If you do not want to shake hands, you don't have to shake hands. If you want to talk, you can talk. If you want to stand there and be quiet, you can stand there and be quiet. There's no pressure. No one cares. You can do whatever you want. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. If there were more geeks in the world, it'd probably be a lot easier of a world to sort of just kind of chill out in. So, yeah, experience the geek community at Ohio Linux Fest. And that's the end of that public service announcement. I have been thinking lately about how I approach my Linux boxes and how I used to approach OS X, or how I still approach OS X if I know that it's a computer that I'm going to have to come back to on a semi-regular basis, things that I have to manage, keep updated, things like that. Needless to say, I try to avoid approaching OS X at all. If I don't have to get involved with it, then that makes me very happy, and more often than not, I can do that pretty well. I can do that fairly effectively. I carry around whatever live CD I've got on hand. You know, I always carry that with me, so that if I need a computer, then I'll have Linux close at hand. And if it is a Mac that I have to maintain for some reason, if it's broken, I know Macs don't break, but sometimes, believe it or not, they certainly aren't working, and so they have to be fixed. I guess Apple doesn't call that breaking, but that's what I generally call it. Anyway, I do a pretty good job of avoiding them. But one instance back, I think it was last year, it was probably early last year, actually, someone had hired me for a very brief lesson. I believe it was on Final Cut Pro, and I might have mentioned this, so stop me if I've told you, but it was kind of a defining moment in a weird way, because I hadn't been using a Mac for such a long time at that point, and I was telling someone that was going to pay me, you know, hey, I know Final Cut really well. Oh yeah, and I don't have a Mac. That just was weird. The burden was on me to bring a Macintosh to the session with Final Cut on it. So I grabbed, I had a couple of spare MacBooks at that time, like literally two or three. One was running Fedora, if I recall correctly, and the other one I just grabbed and wiped it clean and just threw OS X on there. And it was this sort of realization when I was doing that, that setting up OS X was a really major, major undertaking, interestingly enough. And I found that odd, because I realized that when I installed OS X, it almost felt like a Linux distribution that I was installing that never got right. You know, it felt like that one Linux distro that you just can't really use personally. You know, you respect it, it's Linux, you like it, but you just can't ever get comfortable in it for some reason. Maybe you can't put your finger on it. And that's what OS X felt like. It felt like I was constantly trying to modify it, and it was just never, ever conforming to what I actually wanted it to be. Which is weird if you think about it. It's software. Well, how can it not conform to what I want it to be, or how I want to use it? Well, of course, as we all know, if we think back to our proprietary days, that's actually how software typically is. The fact that we have really, really flexible software in our current daily lives is a result of finding free software. So, here's a completely useless list of presets and configuration things that I do on Linux and on Apple boxes. So, for instance, the number of items in a dock on OS X that I do not discard on OS X is zero, actually. There are two icons on the dock by default that can't be discarded. That's the Finder and the Trash, so technically speaking, there are two that I do not discard. But I would totally discard those if... Actually, I would get rid of the dock if I could, but I can't. So, number of items I change on the KDE Kicker on a GNU Linux system. Well, I ditch the taskbar, generally. Not always, but a lot of times I ditch the taskbar because I never could get used to the concept of a taskbar. And I honestly don't even understand the point of a taskbar. A taskbar seems completely redundant. You've got an alt tab that you can flip through your applications. Why do you need them listed constantly at the top of your screen? It's very, very annoying. Oh, and that's the second thing. I move the whole kicker to the top of the screen, where God intended panels to appear. Kickers and panels and whatever you call them aren't supposed to be at the bottom of the screen. They're supposed to be at the top, because that's where all the information is. You can look up there for your clock and your whatever, and the rest of the screen is for you to use. You don't put the thing in the bottom. It's silly. So those are the two changes that I make on Linux. The number of traditional user-centric applications that are pre-installed on OS X that I use, there are two. I have to use the Finder sometimes, because that's your interface to the computer, and Preview, which is their PDF viewer. I wouldn't use Preview if I didn't have to, but I honestly was not... I haven't really found an alternative, strangely enough. It's either Adobe Acrobat or Preview. I don't know of a real alternate to that, unless I have X11 installed, in which case I can use like Events or something like that. But honestly, those X11 apps are just woefully not integrated, so realistically speaking, Preview is being used. Number of traditional user-centric pre-installed apps on KDE on GNU Linux that I use. I could think of 10 off the top of my head. There was Dolphin, Console, Kwrite, Kate. Yes, I actually use both. Conqueror, Ocular, Copete, Contact, Kmail, Aggregator, Krunner, Dragon Player, GwynView. Those two new ones stand out like sore thumbs without the K's in their name. Kword, Krita, Arc. There are just so many, many applications that I use on KDE that are pre-installed. A number of system kinds of applications, and these are not exact numbers, obviously, because a lot of these are kind of malleable categorizations that I'm coming up with. Number of system apps pre-installed on OS X that I use, I'd say about 5. And again, not really by choice, but they don't really give you a choice. You have to use them in, if you're going to do anything on the thing. System preferences, that's kind of your main control panel. The console, that's how you view your error logs. The activity monitor to see why your computer's running so slow and things like that. Disk utility, because that's just... although I don't always use the GUI version of that. There's a command line version of that that usually I can get by with, but sometimes it's just easier to do the GUI, unless you want to sit there and read the man page for disk util all day. And then the airport utility, which is... Well, actually, and that's another thing. So the network manager, which I guess you would just call airport, but then the airport utility is the thing that you have to use in order to configure airport-branded Apple branded airport base stations. Believe it or not, you know how you get a router from the store and it's like Netgear and you just go to 192.168.1.1 or something like that and there's the Netgear configuration screen and you can do that. And you could do that on a Mac, you could do that on Linux, you could do that on Windows, you could do that on anything with a web browser, your phone, you could do it on Haiku. You know, you could just do it on anything, right? Doesn't care. Airport utility, you have to have a Macintosh to configure. Just so you know, they don't give you the choice to work outside of the Mac platform on that. Unless they do with some kind of Windows system, but I'm pretty sure they don't have that, or if they do, they are certainly not making it very well known for someone who is looking for a Linux solution. So, generally speaking, Airport Utility is the application I have to use for configuring the base stations that I inherited from the previous person who had this job before me. If it were up to me, and the more, you know, anytime I'm buying a new router for this place, it's not an airport one. Number of system applications pre-installed on KDE that I use. The lower number in this case is actually better. So I'm using system administration tools on the command line. So if you think of it that way, I would say that I use system settings and console. And that's pretty much it. And I say it's better because, in my mind, the fewer apps that you have to use, it means the simpler it really is. And I realize that there's some, we could say that, well, you're using console, but within console, you're using a whole bunch of applications. I guess it just kind of depends on your interpretation of all these numbers. This isn't meant to be a scientific study. Number of additional user apps that I generally install on OS X. I could count about 40 because I have a thumb drive with all these different applications that I take around to all the computers in my care and install. You know, I have a script that I run and installs all this stuff. And there were 40 items in the folder. Now, not all of those were essential, must-have, everyday kinds of items, but they're pretty accurate, actually, in terms of, like, if I got a job and I had to use a Mac, there would be about 40 applications that I installed just to kind of make myself feel more at home. And they would obviously all be free applications because that's where I feel at home. And there are a lot out there, really. Some of them would be GUI Aqua kinds of applications. A lot of them would be X11 applications. So then we've got the number of additional user apps that I would install on KDE, typically. I'd say at least 80, maybe more. And you'd think, well, gee, doesn't that mean you're having to set up KDE more? Well, yes and no. I think what that really says is that I'm being able to use more on this cool system that I like so much because it's Linux. Everything's free. There's so much out there that I can use. There's all these applications that I can get to know and learn, and just so many cool things to play around with. So yeah, there are 80 that I install, probably more, certainly more if you count all the little libraries and dependency things that I install, but I do it because I can and because I like the applications. Whereas on OS X, I would love to install a really, really good text editor aside from Emacs. You know, I would love to have Kate on OS X. Not that there's a problem with Emacs, I just mean it would be kind of neat to have other choices, but it's not really that easy. You know, I'd love to have a good feed reader on OS X, but kind of boils down to Thunderbird, you know, and not that there's anything wrong with Thunderbird, I'm just saying you don't have as much choice on OS X, so it's a different story with KDE, or GNU, Linux, whatever you want to call it. I'm saying KDE, meaning on Linux, I don't mean KDE hacked onto OS X, especially since it's really hard to do that anyway. Number of additional system apps I install on OS X, zero, because there's not really any additional system apps that you can install on OS X, unless you would count something like, I don't know, Puppet Management or, you know, some of those kind of network tools or multi-platform Java tools that you might find, although I haven't actually found that much, but I'm sure, you know, they do exist, but I don't use them, so I can't count that. Number of additional system apps I install in KDE. Honestly, I can only think of one. I could be wrong, but Wicked is really the only one I can think of. Number of shell scripts I had to write in order to set up a Mac to make it almost fit my usage. About 5. One to install the different users, one to install my applications, one to do updates, one to fix some bugs that I found, one to install the Darwin port of all the Unix stuff, number of shell scripts I had to write in order to set up KDE to make it usable, 0, because that's just KDE. There are some config files, though, that I bring over, so if you count that as part of the whole setup, then there would be config files. But then that would also increment over on the Mac side, because I bring those same config files, or a lot of those same config files, over to OS X, because there are things like the .emacs file and the trashy application and all these different kinds of things. How closely macOS X allows me to reach fully customizable, personalized user environment? I'd say maybe 10%. Completely arbitrary. I'm just making up a number. But like I say, I never feel like macOS X is my environment. It just doesn't ever reach that point for me. I always feel that I can just barely get through using it because it just does not fit my style in any way. How closely Linux and KDE allow me to reach that fully customizable, personalized user environment? I don't know. 90%, 95%, 98%. It would be pretty high. I'm sure there's something about KDE or Fluxbox or Rat Poison that I would like to change if possible, but I can't really think of anything off the top of my head. So, yeah, it's pretty darn good. So, yeah, that was a completely unscientific, completely useless hit list of the stuff that I like on KDE and the stuff that I just can't do on OS X. It's an interesting thought exercise, though. You should sit down and do it if you ever want to. And if you do, feel free to email me. I would be kind of curious about what other people do about their, you know, kind of the difference between your two systems, you know. I mean, like, all I can say, I guess, to sum it up would be that if you looked at a Macintosh that I had to use on a daily basis, it's just full of free software. The interface, usually there are dozens of different ways to get around having to use the Finder. You know, I'll have Thunar installed, or I'll have Rocks Filer installed, or I'll just be working in the terminal all day. You know, it's just something to keep myself abstracted away from the fact that it's all sitting on this cocoa aqua layer of crippled operating systemry. And on OS Linux, that's a new term, OS Linux, I find myself using different applications for the sheer pleasure of using them. You know, things like launching a Dolphin window just because I can. You know, I mean, I might be in a terminal, I might be able to move a file quite easily right now here from the terminal, but sometimes I'll just open up Dolphin because I like Dolphin. I like how it works. I like how powerful it is. Or I might launch Amarok to play some music in just for fun, just because I've grown to like Amarok. It's a neat little application. Feed readers. I know I can use a dozen different things for my blog feeds. I realize that. But I like the way Aggregator works. I like that it is in the same window with all of my email and stuff like that. You know, it's a completely different workflow, and it's a lot more pleasant on Linux. So I'd be curious to hear the differences between your workflow, you know, the Windows box you have at work and the Linux box you have at home. How do you see the difference? Might be interesting to hear a little bit about, or not. It's hard to say so far in advance. That's it, I think, for this episode. So, as always, thank you for listening. This has been the GNU World Order, and I have been and remain truly yours, Klaatu. You can reach me online via Jabber, not Klaatu at jabber.org. You can find me on Freenode in IRC in different channels like Oddcast Planet. I'm always there. Slacker Media. Sometimes Slackware, sometimes OpenMolar, sometimes NovaCut, just random different channels, but Oddcast Planet for sure. You can find the website at thebadapples.info, and you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. Thank you. thank you for listening, and I will see you next time for episode 18.
OS X Lion borrows a lot from Ubuntu.